Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith, and hope. Discover more interviews at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Hello, this is Stephen O'Doherty. It's one of the greatest adventure stories of our time. The Cassini space probe, launched by NASA 20 years ago, is nearing the end of its mission and in September will run out of fuel. It'll crash into Saturn. But not before completing 22 loops through the rings of Saturn, continuing to transmit data back to NASA until the very end. Well, if you look to the stars and wonder about those things, and even wonder about the deeper things of life, then you're in good company. So too does Professor Fred Watson from the Australian National Observatory. He's an astronomer, author, and one of the best science communicators around. We spoke with Fred Watson about Cassini and the bigger things of the universe, beginning with some dramatic and pretty marvellous audio from NASA itself that tells the story of the last days of Cassini.
Cassini's grand finale is a brand new adventure. 22 dives through the space between Saturn and its rings. As it repeatedly braves this unexplored region, Cassini seeks new insights about the origins of the rings and the nature of the planet's interior, closer to Saturn than ever before. On the final orbit, Cassini will plunge into Saturn, fighting to keep its antenna pointed at Earth as it transmits its farewell. In the skies of Saturn, the journey ends as Cassini becomes part of the planet itself.
Fred Watson, what a joy to welcome you to the Open House program.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's good to be here.
So if you were Cassini right now, if you're sitting on Cassini buzzing through the rings of Saturn, what would you be seeing?
A very close-up view of the planet. And you probably, if you were sitting on the Cassini space probe, you'd probably have your heart in your mouth because of the fact that the last couple of days have seen the first of 22 orbits that take the spacecraft between the rings and the surface of the planet. So this is daring stuff because nobody until now has known what there was in there. It could have been full of little bits of ice and debris. And when you're traveling at 30 kilometers per second, anything that you run into tends to do a lot of damage.
What are the rings made out of?
They're a mixture of rock and ice.
So we know that for sure, do we?
Yes, that's right, because they've been studied, of course, in great detail for many, many years. Actually, until the middle of the 19th century, there was a commonly held view that they were probably something solid. But James Clerk Maxwell in the 1850s did a quick back-of-the-envelope mathematical demonstration that they couldn't possibly be solid because gravity just wouldn't let them be. And so we've known since then, and in fact since subsequent observations that prove this, we've known that they were made of many, many billions of particles. But I think what has been learned more recently about the rings is they are an incredibly unusual system of orbiting bits of debris. So as I said, chunks of rock and ice, probably none of them bigger than about 5-6 meters across.
And did they come from Saturn itself, or were they captured by its gravitational field?
Almost certainly captured. That's right, because these are, the icy component is by far the larger component. What I think is staggering about them is that these rings, well, the main ring system is about 250,000 kilometers in diameter, but it's less than 100 meters thick. So it's like a blade of material running through space.
It will be a wonder if Cassini survives that, though. What's the density of the particles?
Well, the particle density is quite high in the main part of the rings, and it certainly wouldn't survive a passage through there. But what's happening is that the spacecraft is going In the gap between the top of Saturn's cloud belts and the inner edge of the rings. And it's always been assumed, and once again, it's gravitational considerations that let you do this, that would be fairly clear of debris. And having successfully made its first passage through this little gap the other day, it looks as though that is right, because the spacecraft seems to have survived completely unscathed.
Marvellous. Isn't it interesting? We're going further and further, actually back in time, looking to the furthest points that we can possibly see from a telescope or using our radio telescopes or whatever. And here is something that's captivating us because it's so close to home in relative terms.
That's right. And what it underlines is, you know, you're quite right. We do look at things that are literally billions of light years away with our telescopes here in Australia, for example. But even things on our doorstep, there are still lots to learn about them. I always think of it in terms of, you know, looking from a vantage point on Earth. If you sit, on a shoreline or something, and you see a ship in the distance. Once you get a telescope on that ship, you start seeing that it's made of stuff, whether it's steel or wood or whatever. But if you could imagine being right next to it, then you'd see the stitching in the sails and the fine detail that there is. And in a way, astronomy is like that too. We can see Saturn pretty easily through telescopes, but to look in fine detail about what the planet itself is like, what its ring system is like, and most especially what its moons are like, because that's where the most staggering discoveries have been made, that's a different matter altogether. And you actually need spacecraft to do that.
Yes, indeed. What discoveries then have blown your mind about the moons of Saturn?
I guess there are two, although they're linked. One is this little moon called Enceladus, which is roughly the size of New South Wales. It's a spherical body. It's covered with a layer of ice, and that, once again, is ordinary water ice. That layer of ice is probably about 20 kilometers thick, and we know now with certainty that underneath it is an ocean, and the ocean is made of water, and that water is in contact with a rocky core of Enceladus. Mm-hmm. So Enceladus has this structure with a rocky core, a liquid water ocean over the top of it, and solid ice on top of that. And so what you have here is an environment where interesting things could happen. One of the things that was detected only within the last few weeks by the Cassini spacecraft is that ice geysers that actually erupt from the southern polar regions of Enceladus. It's known about these ice geysers for actually more than 10 years. But what has been done is a further analysis has shown that they're rich in what's called molecular hydrogen. And the fact that there's hydrogen there suggests that deep down in the ocean underneath the ice, there are these hydrothermal vents, very like the ones that we find on the ocean floor here on Earth.
Yes.
And we know that that's where life originated. Yes. On our planet. So it's very, very suggestive. So Enceladus is one exciting place, and if I've got time, I'll tell you about the other one.
Yeah, go on, please.
Which is the biggest of Saturn's moons, Titan. And Titan is unique in the solar system in that it is the only moon of any planet that has a thick atmosphere. It's got an atmosphere that's made largely of things like nitrogen and carbon dioxide, but it also has clouds of methane and ethane in it.
So these are organic gases.
They are organic gases, and actually they behave on Titan very similar, or very much in the same way as water behaves on Earth. So they form clouds, they actually rain, but it's not water that's raining, it's liquid natural gas, it's ethane and methane. Yes. And it forms lakes. So Titan,
I guess
they don't
smoke on Titan.
No, you do. You've got to be careful. Yeah. With your matches, that's right. And they form lakes and seas. It's the only place in the universe other than Earth where we know there are stable bodies of liquid on the surface of a world. So
gosh,
it's extraordinary. Once again, though, these lakes are not actually in a rocky environment. They're in an environment made of solid ice.
Yes.
So the surface is actually frozen water.
Yes.
But sitting in that water, frozen water, of pools of liquid hydrocarbons. It's really bizarre stuff and very, very interesting.
On Open House, our guest is Fred Watson. He's the people's astronomer. He's the man who's popularized astronomy for so many Australians from the Australian Observatory. Fred, when you look to the universe, what do you see? I'm going to take you back to that ocean example. You're sitting on the beach, you're looking out and you get out your telescope. You see a ship on the horizon. You get out your telescope, you're having a look at the ship. But you also notice a periwinkle by your foot. And you can be just as, I would look at that as a Christian and say, I'm just as amazed at what God has done with this periwinkle as I am at the ocean and the expanse and the creation of this wonderful world.
I am similarly in awe, Stephen, because I think that when we look, whether we're looking in detail at the periwinkle or whether we're looking, or more especially perhaps when we're looking out into the universe, the overwhelming thought that comes to my mind is how little we actually know. We scientists do actually know a lot about the universe. We think we understand how the universe came into being, although there are still very many questions attached to that. We think we understand how it's evolved in its 13.8 billion year history. But there are some really fundamental things that I think sort of overlap with your question about the wonder of God creating these attributes of our universe. There are some really big questions that we have not got a clue about. We think we understand space at some level, but there are aspects of space that blow our minds that we don't really know about. One of them is that space is expanding ever more rapidly with a source of energy that we simply don't understand. But one of the things that I think is one of the great remaining puzzles of science, and it may be something we can never, ever solve, is what time is, how time works.
Yes.
When we look at, for example, relativity, which is the best theory we have to describe the way things behave in the universe.
Yeah.
When we look at that, it says time is a dimension, just like space is. The equations reveal that very clearly. But we can't move around in time as we can in space. And that then begs the question, well, what's happening here? We really don't understand. There is so much left to try and understand. Whether we ever can or not is actually, I think, another fundamental question.
Yeah.
We probably can't.
So, Fred, do you believe in God?
What I believe in is it's really something that you might call the wonder of the universe itself.
Yeah.
And I don't actually mind giving that the label God, but I can almost feel that there is so much mystery and wonder and, in a sense, almost a moral fabric to the universe that in some ways perhaps it's indistinguishable from God.
Well, what a great answer. And I understand that in your youth you were pretty zealous.
Indeed I was, yeah. And I was very deeply involved with a highly evangelical church. It was modelled on the early Methodists and had, I think, a very stimulating time there. I went off to Italy at one point to sell Bibles because I thought the Italians needed to read their Bibles.
Yes.
That was without speaking a word of Italian. So I didn't really do all that brilliantly as a salesperson, but it kind of, it was good for the soul, I think. As you grow up and mature and get older, you perhaps look at these things more reflectively. I went through a very difficult time once I'd left university, in fact, when I was at university that I was in my firebrand stage.
Yes.
I went through a pretty difficult time where I felt really quite lost and not sure of what my view of the universe and the world was. But that seems to have crystallized into something that, I certainly carry with me to the best of my ability, the Christian ethic. As I've perhaps explained, I think the natural world itself has a wonder about it.
The Bible would agree with you. Paul says we can know God by the wonder of his creation. And you spend more time than most people in the universe, we presume,
looking at
the wonder of that.
That's right. Isn't it Psalm 19 that says the heavens declare the wonder of God? And that's certainly true.
My word, it is. Well, thank you for shedding a little light on some truths tonight as well. Fred Watson, it's been marvellous talking to you. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thanks very much, Steve.